continuing the readings from this chapter called Unsupported and Unsupportive Consciousness. And this next section is related to the teachings on dependent origination. This is from the book of that name by Venerable Paiuto, P.A. Paiuto. That is a very, very worthy resource. I feel the clearest and most helpful explanation on dependent origination that we have in book form. So this is a section from that. So here are some words from an eminent Buddhist scholar of Thailand to help further clarify the meaning of this term, nirodha, which was what we were looking at. And the verbs uparujati and nirujati, meaning to cease or to end or to hold in check. So this is from a part of the appendix of Dependent Origination, and it's entitled A Problem with the Word Nirodha. The word Nirodha has been translated as cessation, quote-unquote, for so long that it has become standard practice, and any deviation from it leads to queries. Even in this book, that's Dependent Origination, I have opted for this standard translation for the sake of convenience and to avoid confusing it for other Pali terms, and apart from lack of a better word. In fact, however, this rendering of the word Nirodha as ceased, quote-unquote, can, in many instances, be a misrendering of the text. And also I should mention that this book was translated into English by Bruce Evans, who was a bhikkhu at Wat Pa Nanachat, and Wat Pa Phong was Puriso bhikkhu. Lumpur Pasanno and I knew him well in those days. So he was the translator of Venerable Paiuto's book from the original Thai into English. Generally speaking, the word cease, quote-unquote, means to do away with something which has already arisen, or the stopping of something which has already begun. However, Nirodha, in the teaching of dependent origination, as also in Dukkha Nirodha, the third of the Noble Truths, means the non-arising or non-existence of something because the cause of its arising is done away with. For example, the phrase, when avicca is Nirodha, sankhara are also Nirodha, which is usually taken to mean with the cessation of ignorance, volitional impulses cease. In fact, means that when there is no ignorance, or no arising of ignorance, or when there is no longer any problem with ignorance, there are no volitional impulses. Volitional impulses do not arise, or there is no longer any problem from volitional impulses. It does not mean that ignorance already arisen must be done away with before the volitional impulses which have already arisen will also be done away with. So that does presume a bit of a knowledge of the dependent origination domain, but I feel it's an extremely significant point. This is why Lumpur Pasanno and I both decided to include the whole of that explanation from Venerable Paiuto's book, because it's a very significant point. When we recite the dependent origination chant, particularly when we do the funeral chanting, in the years when Lumpur Sumato was teaching on dependent origination on the winter retreats of Amravati for 3 or 4 years in the late 80s, we used to just recite the dependent origination chant every day as a sort of a standard part of our puja. So the second half of it is avijaya taveva asesa viraga nirodha sankhara niroto sankhara nirodha vijnana niroto vijnana nirodha. So that nirodha is very much very, very present in that second half of that chant. And so what he's spelling out here, I feel, is a very clear explanation that when we look at the word or explore the word nirodha, to get that breadth of meaning, to understand it, to get a feeling for that is very important. Because also it can be logically confusing. Like, well, how does that work if you have to stop ignorance before you stop the others? And thinking of it in just a sequential process. But the way that he describes it here, I feel, is very, very helpful. His range of meanings, that phrase, with Avijaya when Avijaya is Nirodha, when Avijaya is Nirodha, Sankhara also Nirodha, which he says is also usually taken to mean with the cessation of ignorance, volitional impulses cease. But then to broaden the meaning, when there is no ignorance, no arising of ignorance, or when there is no longer any problem with ignorance, there are no volitional impulses, or volitional impulses do not arise. There is no longer any problem from volitional impulses. So that it's in a way saying that whole second part of the cycle does not arise. It's not given the causes to come into being. But I appreciate that it takes a bit of familiarity with the languaging of that and that as a set of principles from Dhamma teachings. But I would say it's very, very useful principle to bear in mind if you're trying to understand dependent origination. Any comments or thoughts on...
Yeah, just, well, I mean, just to really, even though it sounds a bit kind of complicated or maybe even a bit pedantic, going over a word, but it is incredibly important in terms of how we frame, because we do spend an inordinate amount of time trying to stamp out our defilements, stamp out ignorance, and trying to get them to not be there. But that sense of, well, if we just don't feed them, they don't arise. And it's just not there, it's not a problem anymore.
So any questions, thoughts? Is that clear enough? These readings are for all of you, not just for us to enjoy and expound, but if there's anything of that that needs some spelling out or further explanation, please don't be shy. Yes, there's a hand.
What does the word volition mean?
Volition, it means to intend. Like the word voluntary is related that you put yourself forward, you volunteer. It's like giving a direction to the mind. So intention, volition. The way the mind can direct itself towards an object with energy and purpose. Any other questions? Okay, so it's all perfectly clear. Very good. So to continue then. Where Nirodha should be rendered as cessation is when it is used in reference to the natural way of things or the nature of compounded things. In this sense, it's a synonym for the words bhanga, that's a Pali word, B-H-A-N with a diacritical dot over the top, bhanga meaning breaking up, or anicca, transient, kaya, cessation, or vaya, decay. For example, in the Pali, it is given imanko bhikkhave tiso vedana anicca sankata paticca samuppanna kaya dhamma vaya dhamma viraga dhamma nirodha dhamma. Monks, these three kinds of feeling are naturally impermanent, compounded, dependently arisen, transient, subject to decay, dissolution, fading, and cessation. All of the factors occurring in dependent origination cycle have the same nature. In this instance, the meaning is all conditioned things, sankhara, having arisen, must inevitably decay and fade according to supporting factors. There is no need to try to stop them. They cease of themselves. Here the intention is to describe a natural condition, which in terms of practice simply means that which arises can be done away with. Or that the insight that is quoted, say, in the Buddha's first discourse, the turning of the wheel, the insight that arises in the mind of Venerable Kandanya, Yankinchi Samudaya Dhammang Sabantang Nirodha Dhammanti. That which has the nature to arise has the nature to cease. So that's talking about this natural quality of a thing beginning and ending. As for Nirodha in the third noble truth, or the dependent origination cycle in cessation mode, although it also describes a natural process, its emphasis is on practical considerations. It's translated in two ways in the Visuddhimagga. One way traces the etymology to ni, as in without, and rodha, meaning prison, confine, obstacle, wall, or impediment. thus rendering the meaning as without impediment or free of confinement. This is explained as free of impediments, that is, the confinement of samsara. Another definition traces the origin to anupada, meaning not arising, and goes on to say, Nirodha here does not mean bhanga, breaking up and dissolution. Therefore, translating Nirodha as cessation, quote-unquote, although not entirely wrong, is nevertheless not entirely accurate. On the other hand, there's no other word which comes so close to the essential meaning as cessation. However, we should understand what is meant by the term. In this context, the dependent origination cycle, in its cessation mode, might be better rendered as. So this is avijaya, taveva, asesa, viraga, niroda, sankara, nirodo, sankara, niroda, etc. So, being rendered as, quote, being free of ignorance, there is freedom from volitional impulses. Or, when ignorance is gone, volitional impulses are gone. Or, when ignorance ceases to give fruit, volitional impulses cease to give fruit. Or, when ignorance is no longer a problem, volitional impulses are no longer a problem. The Venerable Paiuto is noted, as we've mentioned before, being extremely thorough. He wants to make sure that you can understand everything very, very clearly, so he regularly repeats himself. But I feel this is helpful in getting a sense of the feeling tone of that word, Nirodha, in this sense, as in sort of non-arising or no longer a problem, as well as a thing that has begun coming to an end. Even in the forward mode, so in the first part, avijja, paccaya, sankhara, and so on, in the forward mode, there are some problems with definitions. The meanings of many of the Pali terms are too broad to be translated into any single English word. For instance, avijja, paccaya, sankhara, so that would mean ignorance, conditions, volitional formations. It also means, when ignorance is like this, volitional impulses are like this. Volitional impulses being this way, consciousness is like this. Consciousness being this way, body and mind are like this. And it goes on and explores that a little bit more. So I hope that is valuable. When I was looking at this with the Anagarikas and eight precepts people in the Samaneras yesterday, one of the things that I was pointing out is that when we use the word paccaya, avijja paccaya sankhara, it doesn't just mean ignorance is the cause of volitional formations, or volitional formations are the cause of consciousness. That paccaya, it means it's related to, it affects, it's connected with. And so the way that the Venerable Paiuto translates it here is like, when ignorance is like this, volitional impulses are like this. But what that this is can refer to a big range of qualities. Another of the aspects of this, again, when we do the funeral chanting, there's other passages we recite from the Abhidhamma. And those of you who've joined in with that in the lay community or in the Sangha, when we chant that, the chant that begins Hetu Pachayo, Aramana Pachayo, and so on, that's called the 24 Patana. So those are the 24 kinds of conditional relations, different ways that these qualities affect each other or connect with each other. So it can be, again, a little bit technical, but it's pointing out there's a big range of ways that things affect each other. And it's not just A causes B, B causes C, C causes D in a very sort of monotone, linear fashion. But there's all sorts of nuances and aspects to the way that one thing conditions another, which, when we're watching our minds in the meditation and during the course of the day, we will notice. The mind is affected in all sorts of different ways by all sorts of different things, different times, different situations. And so the simplicity of the language, we have ignorant, avijja paccaya sankhara, sankhara paccaya vijnana, and so on, it can seem very, very simple. It's represented in a very simple and plain way in the recitation, but it's representing an extremely complex range of relationships Just like you can say, one person, another person. Yeah, that's true. But each of what we call person has got a whole story and a name and a history and a biology and is very kind of complex. And how we relate to each other as members of the community is also very intricate and nuanced. So with the meditation and the cultivation of wise reflection, putting these teachings to work, then it's helpful to bear in mind there's this range of qualities and tones are being referred to or are part of the meaning of these words like Nirodha or Pachaya. So again, so if there's any questions, thoughts, reflections? Yes.
So is this from the perspective of the mind, or is it also from the perspective of the jhanas, the jnanas, where you have a cessation of appearances altogether, or is it strictly on the level of the volition?
Well, it's all related. I mean, in terms of jhana, that means the mind is focused in the present moment, and so is able to pay clear attention to what's going on. So that can be an involved factor, but the mind doesn't have to be in jhana in order to be able to observe these different qualities functioning, and they're relating to each other. So, for example, you can notice that feeling conditions craving in ordinary everyday life very, very readily. So jhana doesn't have to be involved. But if the mind is focused and undistracted, then it can be easier to see the detail of how one thing conditions another. I'm not sure if that's what you were asking.
Yeah, so it's primarily referring to the mind itself that reacts.
Well, mind is a word that covers a big range.
I guess as opposed to absorption and opposed to ultimate cessation.
Well, I wouldn't say the mind is not opposed to absorption. I mean, the quality of jhana is an attribute of mind. I wouldn't see them as being in contrast to each other. It's like that's a faculty of the mind is its ability to concentrate. Another faculty of the mind is it has a capacity to wisely reflect. But those qualities can be present together. You can be in first jhana and also using wise reflection. There was earlier readings that was being talked about in the suttas. So they're not opposed to each other. They're all part of the same system. So I would say when exploring dependent origination and learning to understand it, then the aspect of wise reflection, investigation, is quite active, quite prominent, you know, in that. But that doesn't mean to say that the mind is unconcentrated or that it's sort of choosing between wise reflection or concentration, that those qualities, you know, work together.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't refer to whether appearances are there or not?
Appearances,
just any phenomena appearing to mind.
Well, the dependent origination cycle is, in a way, it's referring to the mind's relationship or how it's attending to the range of experiences. The very fact that it starts off avijja paccaya sankhara, when there is ignorance, when the mind doesn't see things clearly, then it is drawn towards creating a subject-object duality. And that when there is vijja, when there is awakened awareness, then when there is no ignorance, then it doesn't give rise to that subject-object duality as some kind of substantial or seemingly real division. Anything else you'd say on that?
Nothing comes to mind. The main thing is not to get too lost in the weeds, to really pay attention to the principle of conditionality and how things are being affected, because that's where we can untangle the mess.
Okay, so to continue. Although spiritual parallels can sometimes be deceptive, it is tempting at this point to make a comparison between two different spiritual traditions. This is due both to the significance and usefulness of the phrase Vijnanam Anidasanam Anantam Sabbato Pabham, which was that first passage that we were looking at in this chapter. The usefulness of that phrase as a tool for Dhamma practice, as well as the potency and popularity of the Tibetan Buddhist practice of Dzogchen, natural great perfection, in the West these days. In listening to Dzogchen teachings, it's clear that the aim of the practice is to establish the mind in, quote, innate self-arising Rigpa. This latter word, Rigpa, for which the Sanskrit is Vidya and the Pali is Vijja, so Avijja is not knowing, not being awake, not being aware. Vijja is being awake, being aware, or transcendent knowing. So it's variously translated as non-dual awareness, innate wisdom, pure presence, primordial being. Again and again, its principal qualities are enumerated. This is in various Dzogchen teachings that I had attended and be part of. Empty of essence, cognizant in nature, unconfined in capacity. Or, using a different translation of these terms, emptiness, knowing, and lucidity, or clarity. Again, the translations into English vary, but on consideration, the resemblance to the adjectives describing the mind, quote, where long and short, coarse and fine, pure and impure, etc., can find no footing, that the resemblance, at least to me, was striking. To spell it out, vinyanang, equal to cognizant in nature, anidasanang, empty, anantang, unconfined in capacity, sabato pabang, lucid in quality. Whether or not this is a valid alignment of principles is for the individual to discover. It's my effort to apply deft footwork. Someone might find, a Theravadan traditionalist might be utterly outraged and offended and upset, or a Tibetan practitioner like, how dare you? Or the mind might go, oh yeah, that lines up pretty neatly. So I employed that sentence to give people some wiggle room to agree or not agree as they were inclined. So whether or not this is a valid alignment of principles is for the individual to discover. However, as both of these teachings ostensibly point to the nature of the heart liberated from ignorance, it is illuminating that these two traditions, now so widely separated geographically, should hold such similar teachings as key distillations of their wisdom. Any comments, questions, thoughts on that? Abhayagiri Monastery, where we were living, where Lumbor Pasano is still based, is about an hour or so south of a centre that was established by the lamas who are the sons of Tulku Urgyen, Tsokni Rinpoche, Mingje Rinpoche, and Chokyi Nima. It's about an hour's drive north from Abhayagiri, so that we would occasionally go along to retreats they were holding there, or if they had visiting teachers, monks or other lamas were there, joining with retreats they were having from time to time. So it was quite a natural connection. I think Mingje Rinpoche stopped in at Abhayagiri once or twice on his way up there.
Stopped in a couple of times, yeah.
So
stayed.
And Venerable Holger Yeshe is a student of Mingje Rinpoche, so he's sort of connected with that group. So anyway, there's quite a bit of...
Ajahn Yaniko still takes groups up regularly when Chokyi Nima is teaching.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and also they stop in there. Oftentimes the monks, when they're going on Tudong, will stop in at whatever it's called. I can't remember now. The place.
Their center,
yes. And the community that's there. And they're always really happy to see Tudong monks show up.
The name will come to us at some random moment, I'm sure.
Maybe not a moment.
So, okay, so continue then. As a final comment on this passage, that's Vinyanang and Yasnang, Bhikkhu Nyanananda explains it thus. The last line of the verse from that sutta, the Vinyanang Anidasanang, Kevada Sutta, the last line of the verse stresses the fact that the four great elements do not find a footing, and that name and form, quote unquote, comprehending them, can be cut off completely in that Anidasana Vinyana, the non-manifestative consciousness of the Arahant, by the cessation of his normal consciousness, which rests on the data of sense experience. This is a corrective to that monk's notion that the four elements can cease altogether somewhere, a notion which has its roots in the popular conception of self-existing material elements. The Buddha's reformulation of the original question and this concluding line are meant to combat this wrong notion. If you recollect the teaching, it's come into this mind to ask the question, where is it that the four great elements cease without remainder, earth, water, fire and wind? Where do they come to an end and cease without remainder? And so what Venerable Nyanananda, and this is from his book Concept and Reality, what he's highlighting is that he's following the delusion that the material elements have some kind of innate self-existence, and that the Buddha's approach, rather than validating that or confirming that, says that instead of thinking of the elements of having their own self-existent nature, instead look at the experience of the mind of the elements, earth, water, fire and wind, long and short, coarse and fine, and all those polarities. So it's not whether earth, water, fire and wind have some kind of permanent, absolute, stable existence, but how does the mind experience them? If that makes sense. So that is an area that the Buddha was very, very conscious of, that people who were eternalists would tend to believe everything exists, and the nihilists, those who are following the Uccedavada, would say, oh, nothing exists, and that those are the two extremes, philosophically, people would incline to. All exists as one extreme, all does not exist as the other extreme. And if you remember that dialogue between the Buddha and Kachana, this was spelled out. Without adhering to either of those extremes, the Buddha teaches the Dhamma by the middle way. It is with ignorance as condition that formations come to be, and then goes into the whole explanation or the spelling out of Paticca-samuppada. And that was also the passage that Nagarjuna quotes in his treatise on the root of the middle way. Yes, question.
Is that specifically what middle way is the reference
to? The term middle way is pretty broad. It's one of the things. But in that sutta, it's specifically quoted. The Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle way. It is with ignorance as condition that formations come to be. In the Dhammacakka Sutta, the Buddha's first discourse, the middle way is used to refer to the difference between self-indulgence and self-mortification. Trying to find happiness by fulfilling desires, or trying to find happiness by destroying and frustrating desires. And is pointing out that self-mortification and self-denial, self-torture, and self-indulgence, both of those are the extremes, and he teaches the middle way. And in that instance, what he uses to spell out the middle way is the Eightfold Path. And what is that middle way? When we recite the Dhammacakka Sutta, if you look at the translation, it says, what is that middle way that is described by the Tathagata? Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, and so on. In that dialogue with Mahakachana, the middle way is described as Paticca-samuppada. In the Dhammacakka Sutta, it's the Eightfold Path. And there's numerous other ways that it spells. It's a very broad term or phrase. Venerable Nyanananda's language is quite refined and hard to follow. Even if English is your first language, it takes a couple of runs through to get exactly what he's pointing to. And most of us probably don't think too much about self-existent nature of the four elements during the course of an ordinary day. But it's pointing out the shift of the Buddha's attention is we can't talk about the world meaningfully other than our experience of the world. And in the next passage, where the Buddha's dialogue with the Deva Rohitasa, that's a key element of that, that when we talk about the world, loka, and he says, what is the world? So the point that he makes is that whereby one is a perceiver of the world and a conceiver of the world, that is what is meant by the world, loka, in this Dhamma discipline. And then what is the means whereby one is a perceiver and a conceiver of the world? The eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. So that what the Buddha's saying, and again, it might seem a bit of a refined or a pedantic issue, but we can't meaningfully talk about the world away from our own experience of the world. And that that is in European philosophy what would be called a phenomenological approach, that you are not talking about what's really there, the thing in itself, the Ding an sich, I think is the German phrase. Thank you. Holger Jesch is also German, so helpful German consultant. the Ding an sich, the thing in itself, but rather the Buddha's approach is, well, it's only meaningful to talk about our experience of what we call the world, rather than trying to talk about a world apart from the mind's experience of it. That's what I feel, as I understand it, what Venerable Nyanananda's highlighting here. The monk who was wondering, where is it that the four great elements see through that remainder? The Buddha shifts the view, like, well, let's not talk about that as the world, but rather where the world cannot find a landing place. That's what's meaningful, that's what's useful, that's what is significant, is that the citta, the heart, can be cultivated to a quality of clarity and non-entanglement, non-grasping, whereby the world and its polarities, long and short, coarse and fine, pure and impure, earth, water, fire and wind, and so on, they're not given a landing place, they're not given a footing, they're not given a false substantiality. Any other questions, comments, thoughts? Yes, another one.
Is conceptual proliferation an aspect of origination?
It can be. In the classical rendition of dependent origination, there's the sequence sense contact, feeling, craving, clinging, becoming. If the sense contact is conceptual thought, and then the feeling of interest or excitement or irritation or anxiety or the Vedana, pleasant, painful or neutral, then that can condition tanha, craving, to follow that thought and pursue that worry, pursue that irritation, pursue that desire, pursue that opinion. And then that tanha, that craving, conditions upadana, grasping, and that conditions becoming. And that's the dense tangle of papancha is right there. So it's particularly related to, I would say, thought as a sense object. But it can be involved in various other ones as well. But conceptual proliferation is part of that. But the languaging of dependent origination is a bit broader. It doesn't just involve thinking. It can be to do with sight, with hearing, with feeling, with, you know, smells, tastes, touch, you know, all kinds of emotions and moods and so on. That's how I would read it. Yes.
You mentioned existentialism and nihilism. It's a familiar Western philosophical sort of ideas. Mm-hmm. So it's not, so I understand that Buddhism philosophy approach is not one and not another. How other Western philosophical ideas like solipsism or materialism, how do they see it? Because when you describe everything is just in your own mind, it's nothing there.
Well, it's not to say that there's nothing there, but it's rather like, Wittgenstein, mm-hmm. and my other German phrase, wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen.
Thank you.
One of my few German sentences, badly pronounced, but whatever cannot be spoken of, the mind must necessarily pass over. We can only meaningfully speak about what we experience. And if language and concept can't describe it, can't address it, then it has to be left aside. There's a number of things, like materialism, speaking about the four elements as attributes of material form, but not anything that's absolutely, fundamentally kind of real and substantial, is part of Buddha's teaching. So Buddha Dhamma is not materialistic. Solipsism, the idea that the mind conjures up everything and there isn't really anything there at all, that my mind is the only real thing in the universe and everything else is just conjured up.
Sounds similar. Hmm? Maybe I don't understand detail, but it sounds very similar to what you were describing.
Well, I didn't study philosophy at university, but the little bit I know, Bishop Berkeley, after whom Berkeley in California is named, was a philosopher, and he talked about solipsism, the idea that things only exist when you pay attention to them, and that because he was a bishop, grounded in Christian theology, he took it as a proof of the existence of God, that things sustain themselves, that God is always watching everything. therefore the world of things sustains itself. So that was, as I understand, Bishop Berkeley's part of his philosophy. And to come up with another quotation that sort of sits in my memory, as a limerick that describes this, or two limericks, these kind of five-line poems. There was a young man who said, God must think it exceedingly odd to find that this tree continues to be when there's no one about in the quad. Because Bishop Berkeley talked about this oak tree out in the quadrangle of his college, as an example. And then the answer to that is, dear sir, your astonishment's odd. I am always about in the quad. That's why this tree will continue to be, signed, yours faithfully, God. So it's a kind of synopsis of Bishop Berkeley's thesis. So the Buddha wasn't teaching that, but he tried to keep it kind of simple and clear. And so this, I feel that the Buddha's approach is very accurately echoed in the phenomenological teachings of people like Husserl in European philosophy. Also, you have in materialism or Plato's philosophy of the realm of ideal forms, the eidolon, the primordial microphone or the primordial person or cushion, or that there's a realm of ideal forms that cushion participates in the ultimate ideal cushion that exists in this sort of different plane. So that's definitely not connected to the Buddha's thinking or idea. The realm of ideal forms would not fit. But there's probably whole books that line up Western philosophy and Buddhist teachings that I have not read. But a few of those prominent teachings, like solipsism or materialism, I would say they veer away from what the Buddha taught. And in the Buddha's own time, there's quite a few of the other spiritual teachers who had those kind of views, that had the nihilistic view, what's called the Uccedavada or Sasatavada, the eternalist views and so on. But within Buddha Dhamma, there's no concept of a creator God. There's no concept of an ultimate beginning of things. There's a whole chapter of the Connected Discourses which is on the no definable origin, a whole series of suttas that talk about how you can't describe an origin or an ultimate beginning of things. So that veers away from sort of theistic philosophies or the universe created by a supreme deity, very definitely. So those religious philosophies are the Buddha's teaching is far away from. He is kind of unique in focusing on the philosophy in terms of how it can transform you as an individual from a state of suffering to liberation. That's his sole purpose. He wasn't trying to describe the nature of the universe as a theory or an idea. It's like, what do you do to make a difference with your life? Over and over again, he said, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. He was very adept at picking up the philosophies and ideas and views that people had, and then like a wonderful magnifying glass of focusing it down to like what really makes a difference. I don't know how valuable it is to explore those different parallels, but there are some touch points that I say that is quite close, like I say, with phenomenology. But the purpose of the Buddha wasn't trying to create a philosophical description of the universe, but rather giving practical tools to human beings, living beings, as to how to work with the experience of the present and this life, to use the opportunity to enable the citta to awaken to reality and to be liberated. Over and over and over and over again, that's the purpose that he focuses on.
Yeah, it feels like it's other way around, because philosophies usually try to create philosophy from which you pull down how to live your life, but Buddha is other way around.
Other way around, yes.
Talking about how to live your life and the people like trying to create philosophy how to it. So probably it's why it's so, for me at least, it's a little bit other way around.
Yes, yes. And so many people got into dialogues with the Buddha and trying to sort of prove him wrong or try to promote their own philosophy or you can almost sort of feel the Buddha rolling his eyes like, oh. This is what makes a difference. Yeah,
yeah, because it's wrong thinking.
Yeah, this is how I would read it, that he's extraordinarily patient with a broad variety of different views and opinions that people had, and over again it's just bringing it back to dukkha and the ending of dukkha.
What's the net of views in the first discourse of the 62
wrong views, yes.
62 wrong views that the Buddha elucidates in his day.
And he was quite aware that the way he spoke was frustrating to people. So when they said, well, what happens to an enlightened being when the body passes away? They must feel some really fantastic result that comes from all of this, and that after the body's gone, where does an enlightened being go? He wouldn't utter a peep, not a word on that. This is how to practice to arrive at realization. What happens after the death of the body? It doesn't speak about it. Or the ultimate beginning of things, like over and over again, no discoverable beginning. But you've got to have some theory about where this all came from and where life and the mind and the universe, and nope. He was seemingly quite content with people misreading his approach. That you, if you knew, you would say, that's your assumption. To me, it's amazing how he's very stoic. Stoicism from the Greeks, I would say, is quite close to Buddhist practice. He's quite stoic in like, okay, what you say is not what I teach. What I teach is suffering, the end of suffering. And that he was not drawn on that, talking about what happens to an enlightened being after the death of the body, or the ultimate beginning of things. Or he was, in a sense, recognizing that people were going to misunderstand him, misread him and misrepresent him. And then when it was appropriate, he would spell out how people were mistaken. But he really didn't budge from that clarity and that focus right from the earliest times. It's really remarkable, amazing and wonderful that he was so clear from the very beginning and just stayed on that track of a very practical set of tools that people can use to bring about their realization of the mind to know and to embody Dhamma. So let's go to the next part then. The words of these teachings are echoed in another episode recounted in the Pali scriptures. In this passage, the Buddha is approached by a deva called Rohitasa. It seems that in former times, Rohitasa had been an accomplished yogi, a skywalker who could step from the eastern to the western sea of India. He said to the Buddha, "In me, Lord, there arose the wish, I will get to the end of the world by walking. I walked thus for 100 years without sleeping, and pausing only to eat and drink and answer the calls of nature. Even though I exerted myself thus for 100 years, I did not reach the end of the world, and eventually I died on the journey." To this the Buddha replied, "It is true that one cannot reach the end of the world by walking, but unless one reaches the end of the world, one will not reach the end of dukkha. It is in this fathom-long body," a fathom is about 2 meters, 6 feet, "in this fathom-long body, with its perceptions and ideas, that this world, its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to its cessation are to be found. One who knows the world goes to the world's end. One who lives the holy life with heart serene, they understand the world's end and do not hanker for this world or another." So hanker means to long or to agitate for, to wish for. "They do not hanker for this world or another." Both Rohitasa and the errant monk in the tale told by the Buddha to Kevada have been looking in the wrong way and in the wrong place, looking for finality in samsara, which is endlessness itself. That exchange with Rohitasa, it's connected to that definition of loka, of the world, in that other sutta that I was quoting. That is to be found in chapter 35 of the Connected Discourses, which is, I think, on the six senses, the Salyatanavagga, and it's sutta number 116, if you want to look it up. And he says that the world, what is the world, whereby one is a perceiver of the world and a conceiver of the world, that is called the world, loka, in this Dhamma and discipline. And what is it whereby one is a perceiver of the world, loka sanyi, and a conceiver of the world, loka mani, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. So he's saying the world is our experience of the world. And so I'd like to point out, the experience of the world is not just a dream, it's not just invented or imagined out of nothing. There is the four elements, the rupakanda, the material world, but the human mind's experience of the four elements is based upon our human birth and the sense organs. So in that teaching, the Buddha is saying that we can only meaningfully speak about the experience of the world. So even though we use the expression here, the world out there, and we feel that we experience the world, what I like to point out is none of us experiences the world. Every single one of us, like right now, every single one of us is experiencing our mind's representation of the world. Right? You can't really argue, we probably could argue with it. But the way we see this room is based on our eyes. If I have our eyes open or eyes closed, where we are sitting, what we see, it varies from the place that we're sitting. Our language, our memories, the whole variety of things that we experience, they are put together and they make our experience of the world in this moment, sitting here in the sala with the daily reading. It's like this. But every one of those is different. And again, in philosophy, Western philosophy, there's a sort of idea of it's possible to speak about the world and reality away from the human conception. I would say close to that phenomenological approach or Wittgenstein and so on. To speak about a world apart from the mind's knowledge of the world or perception of the world, it has no real value and no real meaning. Again, that's a very abbreviated version. It might be frustrating, but I want to see the real, I want to know the absolute reality and what's the real truth of, you know, how it actually is. But that's necessarily through the agency of the human mind in this birth, in this condition. So the Buddha is saying, well, that's our experience, so work through that channel. Don't try to create an idea of a reality that's known totally objectively. That's not really possible. But we can use this very experience, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. We can use, even though it's conditioned by our birth and our language, our memory, our experience, that can be used, that can be the medium whereby the mind knows the field of experience and is liberated from bondage to it, liberated from identification and limitation through that. So we don't have to look at the need to know the world through the channel of our own experience. It's not a weakness or a limitation. The Buddha is saying, use that. That's what we use. This life, this mind, these feelings, that becomes the medium that is learned from, that is the teacher. Lumbo Cha, his whole approach was, you know, using the field of experience, the sense world, that's the teacher to learn from how the world works, learning from seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking. That's the medium of instruction. That's what we learn from. Any comments, thoughts on Rohitasa in there?
I think it was Bhikkhu Bodhi who said that.
Oh yes, that's true. Yeah.
That's the most important statement that the Buddha made. Yeah, just that.
In Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation that I was quoting there about the world, in this fathom-long body is the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. And that parallel passage, in his notes in the Sanghita Nikaya about that, he said, this is probably the most profound utterance in all of philosophy, of Eastern and Western. And he's not one who speaks in the kind of exaggerated or hyperbolic way. He's very...
He's not prone to hyperbole.
He's very...
His PhD was in Western philosophy. Mm-hmm.
So he knows what he's talking about and saying that's probably the most profound utterance in all of philosophy. It's a meaningful statement. If you want to go to the Sanyutta Nikaya and look up. That dialogue with Rohitasa is in the Devaputta Sanyuttas, chapter 2 of the Connected Discourses, sutra number 26. And then the other one is chapter 35, sutta 116. Okay, leave it there for today.